there isn't a gaming group I've ever been with that wouldn't openly welcome anybody. I don't care if you're trans, gay, male, female. If you identify as a typewriter, nobody cares. As long as you come into the table to play, gaming has been one of the most open and accepted communities out there. They always act like there's this barrier that's somehow preventing women from playing. And I said, maybe it's because they don't want to play with big, stompy robots.
That's the thing, though, you're not allowed to say.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I'm going to say it.
Hello and welcome to CultureScape, the show that interviews the geek creators and influencers that built nerd culture. Today we are going to talk about mechs, Gundams, Transformers, Xenogears, or whatever else you want to call your favorite big stompy robots. With me today is Blaine Pardoe, a New York Times bestseller who pretty much, with the help of a few others, built up Western mech literature, and over 36 years built up the tabletop RPG and wargame Battletech. However, despite his huge investment into the Warhammer rival, almost exactly a year ago now, Blaine was canceled due to, quote, Mr. Pardoe's online activities. That's very vague, kind of Orwellian, isn't it? By Battletech's owner Tops and its manager Catalyst Game Labs, who inspired this cancel culture act against one of the most preeminent mech writers. Well, he was accused by his stalker of being toxic and, this is going to shock you, conservative. Yes. Off the clock. Unfortunately, this takeover of Battletech follows a long list of other fan and nerd franchises, including Warhammer, Star Wars, Star Trek, and many more that have been taken over by the Skulls. Today, we're going to talk about the big stompy robots this whirlwind Blaine found himself in, and why these companies keep caving to people who rarely play these games and even more seldom buy these products. And for today's stupid nerd question, we are going to ask Blaine, what is his favorite mech property outside of Battletech? It could be anything. It could be Armored Core or Gundam. It could be maybe Robotech or Macross. Perhaps Warhammer. Perhaps all these years, he's actually a huge Warhammer stan. And that's really why they fired him, because they're like, oh no, we can't have him here. He's too big of a fan of Warhammer. Well, to find out the answer to all this, you will have to watch the show and stick around. Welcome to CultureScape, Blaine. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's exciting. You're a very well-to-do author. You've had a lot of influence on pop science fiction, especially around mechs, which have become more popular, not to the main popular zeitgeist, but have beginning up there. It's like any day now, breakthrough. And a lot of that really goes to the work that you've put in. And you're a prolific author. It's not just the mech stuff. You've written some political books. You've written some books outside of that genre with different publishers. You've done pretty well for yourself, which is why it still shocks me. I just do not understand it. It's insane that you were fired. You're basically like one of the best, probably the most successful writers Tops had. And they're just like, no, he's got to go.
Yeah. My book, Hour of the Wolf, was, and I was told this by Catalyst, their number one selling piece of fiction that they had ever produced. It's 4.7 or 4.8 stars on Amazon. It's got hundreds of reviews. It was a shock to me too. But I'm not entirely surprised. There's a large contingent of people out there that like going after conservatives, and they don't like anybody who has an opinion that varies with theirs. So it was a strange circumstance. I was really surprised that Catalyst took the side of a person that was stalking me online and harassing me online, who I had a protective order against and still do. It was a real shock. It was a very big disappointment. But, I picked up my toys and went somewhere else and started a whole new mech series. So, and it's been selling on the bestseller lists, and I moved on. It's their loss, not mine, really.
Yeah, and that's the thing, though. It's like you're a big enough author. It's like them losing you is going to hurt them more than you. And because the relationship between, in Battletech, especially between the authors and the game players itself, it's like they're really just, cutting off their nose to bite their face. It's like, why do this? It's only going to hurt you long term. You've had a year to think about this, and I definitely want to go into the ins and outs of this, and more importantly, into like to your writing, your books, what inspires you. But I think the, you know, what people like to know is the juicy stuff. So I'm putting this up front. It's been a year. You've had a chance to really ponder on all this that happened. Why do you think ultimately was the reason that they decided to betray you?
I would say cowardice. You know, I was told that there were, and I was shown the messages that from five different email accounts or five different Twitter accounts that were involved with this. And I even questioned at the time. I was like, yeah, how do you know this isn't the same person spinning up different accounts? And they were like, it doesn't matter. To me, this was cowardice. That's what led to this. They were afraid that somebody was going to say something negative to them. Yeah, I got accused of being all sorts of things I'm not. That was very hard to go through. Yeah, I got told I was a misogynist. And, you know, I said, what did I do that was misogynistic? Where, you know, was it in my books? Was it in something I posted? Where was it? And they were like, well, you posted some nasty stuff about, you know, Joy Behar from The View. And I looked up the tweet that I sent, and it was a picture of Joy Behar, and I posted, you could throw her in a pond and skim ugly for a week. Now, I if I offended anyone just, who's sexually attracted to Joy Behar, I'm really sorry. But, you know, for me, that's funny. It's not misogynistic. And what they were doing was trying to take anything that I said and they twisted it. And I think Topps was a coward. I think they're owned, you know, by Fanatics. I think Fanatics was a coward. They were worried that there was a larger group out there that was going to be upset by anything that I posted. And I'm sorry, it was a, you know, sometimes a good cigar is just a good cigar. Sometimes I'm just posting stuff to be funny and it's not intending to hurt anyone. And there are people who spend their lives on the internet looking to be offended. And apparently I crossed with a few of those, and it's a shame.
Well, it's beyond ridiculous because the standard for social media, and this is what it's expected as much from authors as anyone else now, is that they expect you to be online and they expect you to be generating interest, attention, traffic. But the only way you do that is by playing the game. And the game is like, you know, sarcastic, slightly kind of mean, a little boastful. It requires a certain kind of attitude. And then it's like, as soon as they want to find a reason to get rid of you, that they can go to the social media that they, you know, sort of kind of encouraged you to get into. And they're like, ah, there it is. It's like they told you, go build the platform they're going to later hang you in. It's ridiculous, but this is the kind of thing that happens over and over again. I mean, for previous guests we've had on, they can tell you very similar stories from Larry Correa, you know, to Ethan Van Sciver and on. I mean, it's a very common tactic. It's embarrassing, but this thing seems to keep happening.
Yeah, it does. You know, and what really bothered me was the way they treated the fans about this. And you know, When they came back and said, we're canceling all the contracts for stuff you've written going forward, and I had books, novellas, and stuff that were complete, the fans were waiting for them. Some of the fans were actually in the books and in the stories. They canceled them. And, you know, I was like, you got to tell the fans. I made it very clear. I said, but you're not going to throw me under the bus for this. If you come out and say it's because these terrible things you want to call, these people have called me, you know, I'm not going to stand by for that. They opted to do nothing. So they canceled the contracts. The fans who were waiting for these products were left hanging. And they haven't delivered on a lot of the products. You know, they didn't put anything in the library to replace them. But they kept my existing library of books out there and continue to sell them today. So the level of hypocrisy there is just staggering. You know, if I'm that offensive, take all my books down. Don't sell any of them. You know, and that wouldn't bother me, by the way. If they wanted to do that, go ahead and do that. But the fact is, they were like, we're more than willing to make money on your old stuff. We just don't want to do anything with you going forward. And they never told the fans about it. And that's why I came out and told the fans about it, because I was like, this is what's going on. And you know, it took months for us to even resolve how much money they owed me and to actually get that money. And it took the better part of 6 months before that got resolved.
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of publishers are kind of doing something similar where they're not usually this vocal because they're not usually this stupid. But, you know, you see this in Star Wars. So when Disney did the buyover and something happened and they were like, okay, we only want the certain kind of author, and they tend to be, you know, the very diverse, progressive, equity type people. And there's not necessarily wrong with those kind of people, but it's very much a flavor. And if that's your only flavor, it's like going to the ice cream shop and they only have vanilla. Well, that does it for some people, but you're leaving a lot of money off the table. But they're never so stupid as to say out loud or to be that apparent, well, we're canceling him because we don't like him because he's a very bad person, but we need money. And we really like money, and money is great. So we're just going to keep selling the stuff that makes money. And they do that kind of thing with Disney. It's like they'll continue to sell like the old Thrawn books or anything like Drew Karpyshyn, but they don't actually give these people new contracts. We're using you for the benefit of us, but we aren't going to give you work now or in the future.
Yeah, it is. The level of hypocrisy is staggering. When you're dealing with this stuff. And I felt it was disingenuous to the fan community. You know, having a year to look back on it, I constantly am asked by fans, would you return? And it's like, I can't return because I don't trust the people that are there right now. Even if they showed up today with handfuls of money and said, hey, we made a mistake, all is forgiven, let's come back and do this. I couldn't go back there because I don't trust those people. And right now, writing my own series, the Blue Dawn series and the Land and Sea series, I'm reaching a larger audience than I ever did writing for them. I'm selling more books. I'm making more money. Why would I go back to BattleTech? To be honest with you, BattleTech is still selling only to the pool of BattleTech players. The fiction doesn't sell beyond that like it used to. Back in the day when Penguin Putnam was producing the books, you know, you do a print run and it was tens of thousands of books that went out. You don't do that with BattleTech right now. They're very low sellers. They always sell to the people who are still in the game. In a lot of cases, they're selling to guys that are my age, 60 years old, 50 years old, who played the game and read the books back in the day. So it's kind of weird. I think they made a huge mistake, and they're going to have to live with it. Not me. I'm moving on.
No, that's a good attitude to have. It's the same mistake that comics made. A lot of different nerd products or mediums, they make similar mistakes, and they don't really grow. You know, and that's the whole thing. They often say that they do for the cancellation or going to a new diverse cast of authors. Like, well, we got to expand out. We got to grow our audience. But really what it seems like they're trying to do is less about expanding. It's about replacing. Like, we don't like the current audience we have, so we want another. The problem is it doesn't work. I have yet to see it work.
You know, and they did this with my stalker. They gave this person a contract to write a short story, and they did it because this person was claiming to be a lesbian. And as it turns out, this person's was at the time a 39-year-old guy living with his father, you know, in a town in Pennsylvania. You know, he wasn't a lesbian at all. But you know, their whole thing was, well, BattleTech's a sausage fest. We're gonna give this person a contract. This will bring women in. And I'm like, where's the barrier been for women to get into gaming? There isn't a gaming group I've ever been with that wouldn't openly welcome anybody. I don't care if you're trans, gay, male, female. If you identify as a typewriter, nobody cares. As long as you come into the table to play, gaming has been one of the most open and accepted communities out there. They always act like there's this barrier that's somehow preventing women from playing. And I said, maybe it's because they don't want to play with big, stompy robots.
That's the thing, though, you're not allowed to say. You're not allowed to say that actually
I'm gonna say it. Might
have different interests. You can't observe that.
I'm going to say it. No. It's like, why don't more boys play with Barbie dolls? They don't want to. You know, it's okay. It's not bad. If you know, and there's a lot of people out there who have made their careers out of saying, well, women have got to get into gaming. We have to knock down these barriers. We have to make games that are more women friendly. Where were they unfriendly? Where were they hostile to women? Or anybody else for that matter?
Well, this kind of goes what I said about the replacing audience, because I think certain properties can potentially expand out and they can spin off something else, you know. So Wizards of the Coast did successfully to some degree. They've done a lot of things wrong. I have been very hard on Wizards on this show, but they did successfully broaden out the demographic. And not a lot of people can do that. But Dungeons & Dragons is made in such a way where it could do that. But that's not to say a war game can, because a war game is a very detailed, very specific, very long time impactful. Like, you get into these things and then you go hours and hours and hours and hours. And that's just really hard to get the ladies involved. Now, if Critical Role, the people who did the Dungeons & Dragons live stream with a bunch of B-list actors, if they could somehow do that for Mech War, for Battletech, okay, maybe you could pull it off, but I still have my doubt. Have you ever been to, like, seen a war game tournament, and it's like people 50s, 60s, 70s, and they have, like, those little, they got the little Battleship Oklahoma, and they got their metric rulers?
Yeah.
You ever see, like, a gaggle of women? No, you do not, because that is not a thing.
Yeah, well, and there's this belief that somehow we've got to get them into it. And I'm like, if they want to get into it, get into it. Go buy a game.
No, exactly.
Go to your
local. I'm more than happy
to
have them. It's like how it was growing up. You know, if a lady decided to attend the D&D game night, it was like, wow. You know, this huge, exciting, positive thing. I know that sounds a little sad or desperate. That's just how it is. That's at least how it was for me, you know, back in the day. I it's just such a crazy assumption. I think the other thing you touched upon here is that, and this is a key thing I see in a lot of these cancellation stories, and I think it touches upon some social issues that are kind of controversial, like the trans thing. I think it kind of shows the problem with these people with these issues isn't that, you know, that there are people who are trans, you know, or gay or whatever. It's that there are certain people who are willing to take those special distinctions and, you know, how we want to give people more rope, give them more leniency and abuse that trust. Because it was like your stalker McCloskey was willing to say or do whatever it was that seemed advantageous at the time, including like, oh, by the way, I have these adopted twins. You know, like one day I have the twins, another day I do not. One day I'm a lesbian, the other day I'm trans. It's whatever works right now to make it go my way. And the problem is these companies and our society right now is at such a place where you cannot say, actually, that person is in bad faith. If they have one of those check marks on their identity, it's like you have to turn off your brain cells. And so it's like Tops, your big baseball cards, for Pete's sake. What are you doing?
Well, you know, the problem is there's so many people wanting to cry victim. And we've got a society right now, in my personal opinion, where we've misplaced what a victim is. Sometimes a victim's just a victim. Most times a victim is just a victim. They're not heroic for being a victim. Just because you're the victim, you're not a hero. You're not to be idolized. You're not to be held above everyone else because you were a victim. Sometimes you're just a victim, and sometimes it's because of your own stupidity. And, you know, we've got it now where every time somebody is accused of something that like this, they become the victim. It's like, oh, we have to hold them up. They're above everybody else because of this happened to them. And I think it's a huge mistake in our society. It's a huge mistake in the hobby.
Yeah, I listened to some interviews from you from a year ago on Archcast, on Razor Fist.
Oh, yeah.
You were on Archcast and Razor Fist, and I could tell listening to those, you were still very angry. You were very tense. You felt very frustrated. It sounds like from listening to that and listening to now, it feels like you got more time to think, some time to heal, get some space between you. I think that's good. And you know, I was listening to your show. I had a friend over with you on Razor, and he's like, well, you know, he sounds too grumpy. He sounds like a crank. And I'm like, oh, maybe kind of, sort of. But So my response to that, though, is like, well, wouldn't you be? You know, yeah. Because here's the craziest part of this. So McCloskey, who is literally stalking you, like death threats, you have to get the police involved. You have a trail of evidence. You have proof. You know, you as they say online, you have the receipts. Your company that you're working for, you've worked for these people almost for four friggin' decades. You've probably sold more product for them and inspired more people to get into their franchise than anyone else at the company. They decided not only to say, oh, okay, yeah, we hear your comments, madam, and they have been noted, thank you. No, they give her a job. They're like, no, we want you to write for us. That's crazy. That's like going to a member of the family that was killed by the Mansons, you know, by the Manson cult. And we're like, you know, Mr. Manson, you deserve to come work here. It's just nonsense. That drive me insane, too.
The thing that's tempered me over the last year is we launched Land and Sea, which is a brand new mech series that we're doing. And, you know, the thing took off all on its own. And I was able to look at Battletech in the rearview mirror. A year ago, this was very fresh. And I was still catching crap online. People were making up things on the fly about me and posting it. It was absolute. Some of the stuff was so ridiculous. It was beyond contempt. They still do that, but my whole thing is, go ahead and you do what you want. I'm still successful here, and I'm still doing what I enjoy doing. I'm just not doing it for the franchise you wanted. So you won the battle, but I'm winning the war. So, you know, I'm laughing all the way to the bank at this point. And anybody who thinks that they have successfully driven me into isolation to where I'm censored to the point where I'm not able to publish anymore, go kiss my bestseller list.
It is nice. I'm glad that you've had that success, and it makes me happy when people can rise above. Not everyone gets that blessing, either because they're not big enough that where they could really sustain something, or they don't have the right kind of tenacity or personality. Or, you know, it just doesn't happen. You know, that's a comment sometimes people say to defend cancel culture, but like, look at them now, you know, they're doing great. They're selling more than ever. But it's like, that's in spite of something terrible that happened, not because.
Oh, there was, I mean, some of the stuff was so ridiculous. There was somebody who claimed I was on MechWarrior Online and used a racial epithet online. And I'm like, guy, I'm at the time I was 59 years old. I'm like, when I'm playing, I'm desperately trying even to hit the right keys so I stay alive. I'm not turning on my microphone and cursing at people. And I wouldn't say the things you said I said anyway. But they make up stuff because it's like, look, I have to justify what we've done. And there were a lot of people
exactly.
That now that Faith McCloskey has come out and admitted, by the way, that, oh, I wasn't a lesbian. Oh, and by the way, I wasn't a trans person either. Did this around Christmas time. I don't know what caused this sudden shift of faith. But once they came out and did it, I did have a number of fans reach out to me and say, you know, I said terrible things about you. I really feel bad about it now because I trusted this person. And I had three to five of those fans reach out to me and say that. No, they don't post anything online, you know, whereas before they were blasting me online. But at least they did reach out and say, you know, my faith was misplaced. And I understand that, and I appreciate the fact that they did that. But yeah, a little late, to be honest with you. And while I'm gracious enough to accept their apologies, there's a lot of people out there that piled on and said nasty things and stood behind them who still haven't kind of reconciled with that. And they'll have to deal with that in their own way, I guess.
I guess so. It's frustrating. I think one of the interesting things about what you went through was that it was happening at a point where the conversation was starting to go, well, maybe now cancel culture is over. Maybe now we're finally winding it down. To my keen amateur observation, it seems like it is still happening, but maybe it's less prolific. So, like, they do get people big like you sometimes, but it seems like now, like, I'm a health reporter by day, and there's so many stories coming on medical school. You know, especially on forums, Reddit, social media, you know, people where they're not really willing to say it too loudly in public, but they're willing to say it to each other. And there are people being canceled for things left and right, professors, students, etc. You said the wrong thing. You supposedly did the wrong thing. You looked at someone in the wrong way, whatever the reason is, and now you're done. So I do think cancel culture is a thing. I just think it kind of went underground. And I do worry if people are learning the right or wrong lessons here, or if they think, well, because someone like you was successful, that means cancel culture is a good thing. Like I see this all the time on Twitter. Like some big personality gets canceled and there will always be a few people who say, oh, you know, now you hit the jackpot. It's like, ah.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't feel like it when you're going through it. Let me tell you, last year at this time, it did not feel like I had hit the jackpot, you know, and you start questioning yourself. You go, should I apologize? And then you're like, I didn't do anything wrong, so I'm not going to apologize. And I'm not going to try to correct this because you can't. People form their opinion and they just latch on. And if you start apologizing, it's admitting you did something wrong. And I was like, I haven't done anything wrong. I've done what millions of people did. I voiced my opinions online. Ooh, that's terrible. You know, and you know what? I don't care. I'm entitled to have my opinions. I'm a conservative. I'm proud to be a conservative. That doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It just means I have a certain set of values and morals that I stand behind. I'm not going to apologize for those.
No, neither should you. No one should be. I don't think if you're a communist or you're a crypto libertarian living in the woods of Idaho and you reject modern medicine, I don't think you should have to apologize for your political beliefs or your ideas about how to best organize a society. I mean, unless you're like actually advocating for like genocide or something. I mean, we should be an open, tolerant society, and conservatives should have just must write an opportunity to write a very geeky mech war fiction. As any lefty, I think most people would agree with that. Just not the people that work at Tops, apparently.
Well, it was when you're in the middle of it, you start looking at it going, how can I make this better? And I was in that state last year at this time. I'm not in that state now. I'm not trying to make it better. I'm just going to do what I do it well, and have a good time doing it. The people out there that want to hate me can go ahead and hate me. I'm glad I'm living rent free in their heads. It's kind of funny that they're upset when I post, you know, here, look, my new book's on the bestseller list, and they start posting nasty comments about it. And it's like, you haven't even read it. The book just came out. You're seeing bad things about it. You know, like who's the real shallow individual in this argument? You know, the people that wanted to do that, they can go ahead and do that. I stand by the work that I did in Battletech. I didn't impose my politics in my work. Catalyst admitted that. They reviewed my books and said, hey, we didn't see anything in there that was political, that, you know, where you were pushing an agenda or anything. Well, you know, you're a publishing company. You should have stood up and just said, hey, we're a publishing company. In other words, our job is to put out good content, and you know, what his personal opinions are, or is it personal opinions? They didn't do that. They decided to pander to a very narrow target segment of audience and listen to the woke crowd. And because of that, it's not like it's helped their sales or anything. It's just made them be a company that you have to be a little bit suspicious of. And they kind of stepped on a lot of their conservative fans in the process.
I don't think it's just conservatives, though, that push back. Like we're seeing with Disney, this is on a much bigger scale, obviously. But I think it says something about the cultural conformity. I think it's a signal to the general populace. It's not just conservatives. It's even like some liberals and even a few progressives are like, well, they're not really interested in being intellectually or culturally honest. You know, they're not actually trying to appeal to best value. They're trying to appeal to what is most politically expeditious, which to a very small portion of the population, mostly on the left, that's like, they think that's awesome. They think the conformity is awesome. Like they know a lot of them come from like the baby boomers or Gen X, and they put down conformity. Really what they really meant was they wanted a different conformity. But for most of us, we don't actually like the conformity. We do want broad things. It's like, I love reading a sci-fi author, and he's literally a crazy person. He's one of those people in Idaho in the woods. And I'll go that, and I'll go to someone, he's like, this is why Marx was right. We should take down the kulaks. And I was like, okay, awesome. Like, I disagree with both of these people, but the what they're putting out is so interesting and neat, and it makes me think and engage, and so my brain likes it, and that's awesome. I go to Star Wars, and it just doesn't do anything for me, which is a surprise, because that used to be one of my favorites. I just feel nothing. I'm not mad. I'm not upset. I'm just like, eh. You know, it's like watch the nerd on his first little training wheels. It's like, oh, that's so cute. But I don't need to give it my money, certainly not my attention. So, yeah, you're right. They just shoot themselves in the foot doing this kind of stuff.
You know, Disney and what they did with Star Wars, both in writing and in films, has just not been... They haven't looked at the fan base and said, what do we need to deliver to our fans, and what do the fans actually want, which is good stories about great characters. That's whatever, it's what writers want to produce, et cetera. But they've got to weave some sort of narrative into it, and it diminishes telling a good story about great characters. And that's the hard part. And I think we're seeing it now more and more in films, that there are some original films out there. And I would include Barbie in that. I would include Oppenheimer in that. They're good films because they don't try necessarily to hit a message. They're just trying to be original and different. And people are enjoying them. And it's like, sometimes a cigar is just a good cigar. So, you know, sometimes a movie can be just a great movie and people can go enjoy it. And Disney has wandered away from that big time, and they're paying a price for it stock-wise, and they're paying a price for it in attendance at their parks.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. They bought was probably the most lucrative sci-fi franchise around, and they have totally devalued it. It's really quite impressive. What I mean, yeah, that's really,
it would actually take
epic
effort
failure
to do it. It reminds me of the movie The Producers. It's like, we want to make a movie that's a complete flop.
Yeah. That makes people so angry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Springtime for Hitler. I love The Producers. I love the original. I also like that 2000s-ish remake.
I like the original with Zero Mostel. It's still a classic.
Oh, man. That is definitely not a woke film. You probably cannot talk about that one too much, I guess. Or would you? Well, it is literally anti-fascist, so maybe... I don't know.
You know, honestly, you should be able to talk about whatever movie you want. And if people are going to get upset, then they need to go get upset.
People too often do look for reasons to get upset, which is a shame, because that's kind of why one of the big reasons I started this show with the Good Help Bane books. We are interested in culture. We're interested in building up. I'm tired of just complaining. Like, that's interesting, but I don't feel fulfilled from doing that. So that is like, let's try to focus more on, you know, how we can grow these things, how we can appreciate them. You are someone that's definitely that has shown great appreciation for science fiction and your writing, and the mechs in the genre in general. You're still writing about it. You've almost done this for four decades. Do you want to share a little bit about your story, how you got into becoming a writer, and how you found so much success doing it?
Well, when I was in college, I wrote commercial copy for the campus radio station. I had a job for 3 years at the student newspaper writing for them. They thought I was a journalism student. It wasn't until my senior year that they figured out no one had ever seen me in a journalism class. I was a business student. But I loved doing writing. And right after I got out of college, I reached out to Faza, who had put out the Star Trek role-playing game. And I had come up with an idea for a scenario module for it called the Strider Incident. I sent it to them and they said, this is great, we're going to buy it. And you got to bear in mind, this was back when we were doing stuff on typewriters, okay? We didn't have word processors. They said, but we got this other product called Battle Droids. We got some stuff coming out on this. Are you interested? Well, Battle Droids became BattleTech, thanks to Lucasfilms. And so we ended up, you know, I got offered the very first product that they put out, which is the technical readout. I was one of the first people to do that. I was one of the five authors who wrote the first technical readout. And after that, they just kept calling me going, you want to do this? You want to do this? You want to do this? And I'm like, yeah, I took it. And I wrote for that series for BattleTech. I wrote for Renegade Legion. I wrote for Twilight 2000. I wrote for, you know, so many different RPGs and tabletop games that were out there. I just had a lot of fun doing it. And then the opportunity came up to do novels, and I every year made a pitch for two or three novels. And finally, in 1994, you know, they said, yeah, let's do a novel. And after that, I just started getting offers to do books. And so I started doing the novel series. So it was a lot of fun.
So, yeah, and I should have mentioned this earlier in the intro, but you still are often invested in tabletop design. Which tabletop, so we're thinking about like a role-playing game like Dungeons & Dragons. So that's for some of the stuff familiar with tabletop. And some other things kind of fall into that somewhat like Warhammer Battletech, but that's not what they primarily are. It's so interesting the journey you've had as an author, because it sounds like you did, because many authors, they write like 3, 4, 5. I'm trying to think who recently told me they wrote 9. Like really terrible, bad books. And those are like their practice books before they actually ever got to the real stuff. But it sounds like you didn't really have that experience. More like your training came from working on the source books for what would become Battletech.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And it was a lot of fun back in the day. You know, it was a blast to do those products. And it was fun because I do play the game, and I play a lot of different games. I have a D&D group that I run and stuff like that. I still play. I love playing. For our new product line, Land and Sea, I did the initial design for the tabletop game as well as the role-playing game. So that's in development right now, and hopefully it'll be out in the next year or so. And so it's fun. You know, I got a 3D printer down here. I'm printing miniatures up so I can test the rules, and I'm having a blast. So I'm a 13 or 14-year-old kid trapped in a 60-year-old body.
Oh, that's fun. So when you were starting out, are we talking in the 70s? So that's like, or is it you're in the 80s when
80s,
you start?
80s.
Okay, so you're right after the original generation of like Dungeons and Dragons, but you're not that far away from it.
I still have my white boxed edition of D&D on my shelf.
Oh wow!
I mean, I was 1972 when it came out. I picked it up because game stores only carried like 10 products, 12 products. You know, there was like a shelf or two in the hobby store, you know, and that's what you had to go off of. And I picked it up and I played it. It was a lot of fun back in the day.
Now Wizards of the Coast is embarrassed by all that, though. They kind of want to put down their product and its legacy, its history, say, oh, that was all terrible. You know, this thing where they're saying like, well, of course people think orcs are black people. There you go.
I never understood that logic, because that's never come up in any session.
I know. I've never met a human being in my life. I've attended cons. I've had plenty of role-playing nights. I've been a nerd all my life. I have never met a single person that has ever said that.
No.
I don't know where they find these weirdos.
You know, and I was dealing with somebody else once not too long ago who did some stuff with Wizards and did some stuff with other game companies, and they were involved. He was trying to hook me up with, he had somebody read a book that I had written, and he said, well, he's a social content moderator, and he has a number of things he'd recommend you change so that it's more diverse and inclusive. And I'm like, I don't care. I'm not writing a book to be diverse and inclusive. And my books are pretty diverse and inclusive as it is. I mean, you know, but they have checklists that they go through, and it's like, well, you didn't have a character that was a pronounced transgender person. Well, it's the 32nd century. You know, you need to wake up. There's probably not, that probably isn't going to be a big issue in the 32nd century. If it's a big issue still in the 32nd century, one way or another, then there's another problem that we got to deal with. You know?
Yeah, and it's crazy because at least these bigger companies, you know, like Disney, it's like they can afford that kind of thing. But it's like a smaller company with a more niche product. It's like you only have so much audience, you know, you only have so much butter to spread over the bread. It's like, you don't want to be watering down your stuff. And I know from, you know, friends of mine, family of mine are huge Warhammer fans. It's like part of the bombastity, part of like the rugged military experience that's in the flavor of Warhammer, and to my understanding, to some degree also in Battletech. It's like that is part of the attraction by trying to make it more modernized in its sensibilities, you know, to be more PC, to be more sanitized. It actually takes away from it, because what they love about Warhammer is half the characters are like genocidal murderers that like to take a bag of puppies and you know, roll them down the street or something. I mean, it's not my thing necessarily, but it's kind of like the thing. It's like, it's hardcore, you know, it's metal music. It's that kind of thing. And to the people that want it, it's like, well, it's happy, fun, friendly time, and everyone's nice to each other. Well, yeah, that might appeal to, like, you know, your suburban mom, and there's nothing wrong with that, but your suburban mom wasn't interested in Battletech to begin.
Well, you know, I knew that at Catalyst, my editor, my last year there, when I wrote Hour of the Wolf, came back and said, well, in the first five chapters, you don't have any female characters. So to change one of these characters to be female. And I said, why? And they said, because then you got a female character in the first five chapters. I said, it might surprise you, but in the real world, there are times that only men are in the room. There are times that only women are in the room. I said, I have a number of very dominant female characters that are in the book who are very key to the whole plot and story. They just aren't there. And so you want me to change the sex of a character here? So why? So you can check off a list? Well, yeah, because it's just too many. It's too much guys. We, you know, it'll appeal more to women if you have a woman in that first chapter or second chapter. So just change it. And I said, but how does that help the story? How does that make anything better? Tell me how that works and I'll do it. And we finally ended up at a point where I said, I'm not going to do it because it's stupid.
You know? Well, no one, and it's a flawed idea, because no one's buying a book because the features, a certain sort of character. You know, it's just like, oh, well, guess what? Random death soldier number four. Now he is a woman. That makes you want to buy this book? Well, no, it doesn't. EA does this, like, Tronhearts for their games all the time. So they have one of my favorite moments is for Star Wars Battlefront, right? So it's, you know, it's a game that's like one side you play either the good guys or Republic, and the other side you have the Imperials. And so EA is like, well, if you're going to make this, you have to make sure it meets modern standards. So you have to make sure each side has the same number of different casts of races, and then so you have to make sure that the bad guys, who are literally racist people that perpetuate genocide, you have to make sure one of them is an Asian woman. And part of me is like, wait, that's a good thing. It's like, wait. Are you sure you want to do that?
Well, it's like the whole controversy.
How does that even appeal to someone? Like, I wasn't going to play Battlefront 2 until I found out that you could play an Asian woman in one of the skins. It's like, that's not... People don't think that way, but that's how these companies treat it. It baffles me.
It baffles me, you know, but some of it's driven by the fans, too. You take a look at the whole Sisters of Battle controversy over in Warhammer, where everybody's screaming, we have to have women... you know, be space marines. And it's like, you know, you're trying to violate your own canon there to retrofit something in that doesn't actually exist, you know, which you've got the Sisters of Battle, so you've got women that are there, but nobody seems to care about that because, to be honest with you, they want to read stories about space marines, you know, laying waste to major chunks of a planet. So let the fans get what they want, and they'll determine if that's a real problem. But they're trying to push a social template on stuff right now from a fictional perspective and from a game perspective in terms of canon material that's not realistic. It's just, and it's not going to bring women players to Warhammer if you start having women space marines. It will not increase by a single percentage point the number of women playing Warhammer. That's not the thing that's keeping them away from playing Warhammer. What's keeping them away from playing Warhammer is the cost of playing Warhammer.
You worked like, it's interesting because you kind of remind me of Chuck Dixon in a way, because Chuck was another very successful writer, very successful author. his primarily is comic books for DC. He did very, very well, and he was, you know, they brushed him away, despite he, you know, always selling great numbers of comics, well loved, known as something that was very positive, always helping people out around him, just like you. That's one of the things you were known for. People say, oh, you know, I had this project I was working on, I could work something out, so I went to Blaine, he gave me this advice. Lots of stories like that exist around you. It feels like, you know, their idea that they're somehow on the side of positivity, that doesn't seem to speak true to me. It seems like such a waste. But here's what gets me. Why are the companies themselves doing it, though? Like, your friend who was your manager, I'm not going to name him right here, but, you know, he basically said, they told me, just go and deal with it. You know, get done with it. Solve it right now. What is happening at these companies? Do you have any experience with, like, the leadership at Tops or some understanding? Why is it feels like it's coming from the top where they want these things to be solved that way? It's like, is there a disconnect where the people who own these companies or lead them don't really understand their customers? Is it they just want to be done with it and enjoy their money? I don't know. Like, they could be the Monopoly man for all I know. But I'm curious, since you were there,
I think they want to sweep it under the rug. I think it was more Fanatics, I think, than Tops. Fanatics owns Tops now. And from what I was told, it was a new person that had taken over the account since the merger. And the person told the person over at Catalyst, make this go away. Now, to me, that interpretation was, and I expressed this directly to the president at Tops at the time, or president of Catalyst at the time, I said, then go ahead and put out a statement and say we're a publishing company, and, you know, we support people regardless of what their political views are. We just publish good material, and that's it. His solution was, let's get rid of you, and, you know, or get rid of me in this case. And he's like, you know, we're just going to stop doing work with you going forward. I think that decision, I literally think he was telling the truth, which is a rarity with him, but I think he was telling the truth. I think he was told to make it go away, and the easiest way to make it go away was to say, hey, I'm just going to cut this relationship with Blaine, and I just won't publish anything of his going forward. I, you know, as I said, I really wanted him to tell the fans what was going on and do it in a way that was respectful to me, as well as to, you know, kind of at least make himself not look like a douchebag. You know, he chose to ignore it. He's very passive aggressive and said, I'm not going to tell the fans about this.
I'm going to pass the buck on. I don't want this headache. I'm just going to do whatever I'm told. I'm going to pass the buck on and just throw you overboard.
Well, yep. And he's known me for decades. I don't know why he thought I would be quiet about this. There's nothing in my character that, you know, that would ever point to me just saying, well, I'll roll over and play dead so that the company does real well. Yeah, you know, I've never told people to boycott Catalyst because I don't think boycotts are the way to go, you know, when it comes to that, because I don't think they work. Fans are still going to go out and buy product. You know, Catalyst just had a very successful Kickstarter. So, you know, the fans are still going to buy product, even if you scream and holler to tell them not to. So I don't play that game. But at the same time, I'm not going to be quiet about it. I don't think, you know, I would ever be quiet about it. And I know they probably cringe every time I'm doing an interview just like this. I really don't care. They created the circumstance. They own it. And, you know, I'm sure he has mentally rewritten the scenario to where he is the hero of all this and I'm the bad guy. And that's fine. I don't care. I've moved on and I'm doing my own gig right now. These guys, they're so worried that somebody is going to raise a stink with them that they're going to go, look, I claimed this author was anti-gay or a racist or whatever the label was they wanted to throw on me at the time. You know, and they didn't do anything about it. They're so worried about that bad PR and that bad press. They don't realize that at the same time, what they're doing is, you know, cutting their own throat in terms of some of the stuff that they, you know, had in the pipeline.
Yeah, because now they're basically, once you've caved, you're basically stuck obeying them. You know, I was reading some of the New Testament. I know that sounds like I'm a big evangelical. I was reading the New Testament as one does, and I was reading the chapter, you know, and it's beautiful. I love the King James Bible. I think that 17th century language is really beautiful, the way it's put together. And you know, there it says this wisdom. You know, this is like a 2,000-year-old piece of advice, probably much older than that. It's like, the person who you choose to obey is your master. The person that you are, just, you know, the guy whose tune you are choosing to dance to is in control of you. And it's, if you cave to this stuff, it doesn't stop it. It just encourages more of it. And so it's like, there's no good way to do it but to push back. And two, the only way we can really like try to fight this and show companies, hey, don't fall for this stuff, is to do interviews like this, is to talk about it. And I don't mean do boycotts, but, you know, raise a stink so people realize there are going to be consequences, not only if you don't if you don't fire blame, but there are going to be consequences if you do.
They don't see it that way. They're really worried about having these marginalized groups, and they have been historically marginalized, you know, being offended. And if they're painted as the people that are guilty of causing that offense, they're worried about how that looks to them. I understand the logic. It's and on paper, you could almost justify it as a good business decision. That doesn't mean that it's a smart business decision. It's just a business decision. And they made a business decision. They chose poorly.
That was a bad choice. That was a critical fail. Well, that's kind of like all the juicy stuff. Let's talk a little bit more positive. You know, you now have these successful books. Are you into any media right now? Are you into certain franchise you're reading or watching? Is there another mech franchise that you really like? I know you're into D&D, so maybe you're doing a lot of tabletop lately.
No, I need to get the D&D game going again, because I've just been kind of heads down writing lately. I do a web series where I read books and then review them with the authors online, which is always fun because you can kind of torture the author hearing a review of their book for the first time. I've got so many. Drop Trooper, Rick Partlow's series is fantastic, and Rick's such a great writer. I just started Grimm's War with Jeffrey Haskell, and I had him on my show today, and I'm already on book two of that. I'm constantly reading a lot of books, especially in the indie space right now, because, you know, we hang together, we hang separately, and so I do a lot in the indie space right now where I've been reading books and stuff. Declan Finn, his stuff is fantastic. So I've been just consuming a lot of that. In terms of stuff I watch on TV, I finally finished The Expanse, which I absolutely loved.
Nice.
The Expanse was just well done, and it was relatively faithful to the books, which I liked, because I read the books along with while I watched it, you know, so I could kind of compare them as I went. And that was really a lot of fun to do. It's been good. There's a lot of good stuff out there, but you got to wade through a lot of crap. In terms of non-stuff that has nothing to do with science fiction, I've started Succession, and I really enjoy it. What a messed up family. And I watch a lot of true crime stuff because my daughter and I write true crime books together. So, you know, we watch a lot of stuff online, and, you know, just to kind of follow the various series and stuff about stuff that we like and kind of compare notes, and always on the lookout for a good case to cover a book.
You know who really likes true crime? Cop families, people into criminal justice. I took a few criminal justice courses working primarily on my undergrad, and it was like all cops. It was like, you know, most of them had foreign military backgrounds of one kind or another. They are all huge true crime fanatics. Like it's a very popular genre, but especially with law enforcement, which I found that kind of interesting.
Yeah, we actually got to go and teach about one of the cases we covered at Olivet College. We got invited in for a lecture to talk about the case and go over it with criminology students, which was a lot of fun, you know, and it was taught by law enforcement. So it was, it's a good time, and I'm always enjoying that. That's a guilty pleasure, and I enjoy doing it. It's something fun I get to do with my daughter. So
nice. But no, that's cool. Okay, so you can choose anything. It could be anime, it could be TV, it could be an audiobook, anything. What is your favorite, not BattleTech or yours, mech franchise or property? Okay,
non-BattleTech, I'm going to say my new series, Land and Sea.
No, that's why I said it can't include your stuff. That's cheating.
Then it's going to be Robotech. And I know that sounds kind of dorky. I can't stand the Minmay stuff. I fast forward through that. Robotech is good, and I do like Gundam occasionally. I will tune it in when it's late night. It's great to watch late night. I enjoy the Gundam stuff, and I really old school Robotech was kind of a gateway drug to, you know, especially when back then Fazza was kind of stealing the ideas for the mech designs or licensing them and stuff. It was kind of cool to see some of the mechs we wrote about actually, you know, on the screen in animation. I enjoyed that a lot.
Robotech is such a weird, it is such a weird thing. It's like this, it's kind of like Speed Racer in the sense that it was adapting multiple Japanese properties and trying to turn into a cohesive storyline. But unlike Speed Racer, a lot of those, you know, what you'd think of as Saturday morning cartoons, if Robotech, at least, you know, during those early years, it actually worked. They grabbed like three different Macross anime and they said, oh, and this is a generational storyline. And they actually made it work. It's the craziest thing. Now, they haven't done much good since, but.
No. The whole concept of an island, big floating interdimensional battleship that could fold and turn into a giant robot with aircraft carrier arms was totally stupid, and I totally enjoyed that, and I still enjoy it now and that.
Well, that's all right. I enjoy plenty of things that are stupid, and you know, if it was one of your inspirations as a writer, that's a total good, because from that came so much else. So much deeper fiction.
Well, and the Wargate Press, who's my publisher, has so many good series I've been diving into. The Forgotten Ruins, where you've got a ranger team that is transported to an Earth where magic and monsters exist. So it's kind of like, what would happen if you could land a group of rangers that had the capability of making their own ammunition, etc.? How would they deal with orcs and giants and trolls and stuff, which is just pure carnage and slaughter. And I love Forgotten Ruin. I love Peter Nealon's stuff, you know, that he's been doing. And I enjoy the Legionnaire series. It's a lot of fun. It's such a good romp. It's an homage to everybody that enjoys good military sci-fi.
What would I choose? You already covered Gundam. The Gundam is probably an easy one to choose, though. Armored Core, maybe, but that's a video game series. Armored Core, though, is so similar to BattleTech. You could almost call it like an unofficial BattleTech game series, because it's clearly that's what it's drawing a huge amount of inspiration from. I've used Xenogears in previous episodes as something that I think handles mechs pretty well. So I'm going to go with Escaflowne. This is a 1990s anime, and it uses fantasy mechs. So it's kind of a fantasy isekai, so it's like Journey to a Different World kind of pastiche, but it kind of works. You don't get a lot of fantasy mech shows.
No.
That's kind of a cool mix. I kind of like that.
Well, Larry Curry and Steve, God, his name's slipping my memory here, just did a book on their Servants of War. Is a good book series that kind of ties, it's almost a World War I fantasy book with mech suits that's really kind of good. I mean, you know, it was so different that it worked perfectly. And it's Larry Correa and Steve Diamond, and both of them are great writers. I always love Larry Correa's stuff. I follow Larry Correa online just because Larry Correa interacting with people who don't like him is like, it should be a TV show. You know, he's like a pit bull on speed, man. He locks his jaws onto somebody that comes at him and he just takes him right to the ground. It's a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, if you're the Sad Puppies campaign stuff, you know, with the Hugo Awards, which is kind of like that was like one of the early ones where like something terrible had happened, or like
Oh,
these
yeah.
institutions were being taken over. EA's story is it unlike yours, actually, too
Well, you
much.
look at Dragon Con, they've cut out doing military sci-fi as a category for their awards. And I'm like, why would you cut that out? It's literally one of the most popular and heaviest read genres in science fiction. Why are you cutting it out? It makes zero sense.
Because people are saying it's very, I've heard some people say, oh, that's the conservative science fiction. Of course, you know, you say, oh, I read military science fiction, and they roll their eyes. Oh, of course he does. You know, they're sipping their wine, and they're wearing their fancy suit. And however they put it in Simpsons, it's like, oh, one of those people. They should be reading the short story anthology about the gender queer purple aliens, whatever. I'm done with that bit. But it's stupid. It's stupid because it's like, yeah, it outsells everything else by like a country mile. I don't know why people look down upon it.
They look down upon it because they want something more highbrow or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? Sometimes people just want good old-fashioned gunplay action and military operations with lasers and blasters and stuff. That's what they're looking for. And you can sit and deny it all you want, but it's still one of the most popular subgenres of sci-fi.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong. I mean, you can have Flash Gordon and you can have highbrow. There's nothing wrong with having both. Whatever. Whatever. People are stupid. I don't even know how many of those people that complain actually read books to begin with, to
They're
be
not,
honest.
I don't think they're as big a faction. It's funny because the companies react to them like they're going to be protested and it's going to have an impact. And I'm like, call their bluff because I can tell you they're probably not buying your books as it is. They're probably not buying your product as it is. They're not this dominant force because they're not a huge dominant segment of the population. So why are you reacting to that?
Yeah, that was a great observation you made on Razorfish show last year. And he pointed out he was watching this Twitter poll they had put out, trying to like justify what they had done. And it was very clear that they had botted it because it was like there was no one clicking it for days. And all of a sudden they like every few minutes they would get like 300 hits, 1,000 hits. And they'd be like all in favor of them. And it was like, that is very clearly bot traffic. But the fact that they had to stoop to getting bot traffic to somehow defend what they had done kind of says a lot about this imaginary audience that they're catering to.
Yeah, they didn't get the answers they wanted, so they cheated. It's weird. It's funny to look back at it now because I kind of chuckle at it. Like, seriously, you spent money to sway an internet poll just to try to prove you were right? That's so stupid.
It is. I don't know how much that goes for. I mean, I don't know. I only barely know how the bot, the what do they call it? The social media gray market works. So I have no idea how much it costs. I know for YouTube for the cheap, I think they say it's like $10 per thousand, but I don't know what that applies for Twitter. I would imagine it's more because YouTube's easy. You just get a lot of people to. You just get some click farm from Malaysia or China to, you know, to click a video, so click a link, wait 3 seconds, move on to the next. I don't know if Twitter, that'd probably take more work, but I don't know. It's all ridiculous. It's all farcical and ridiculous and silly. And hopefully they never go out of business, but if they do, you know, you can insert the meme of you dancing over their grave and it'll be certainly well earned. That's
It'll, you
my
know,
opinion on that.
I was there before some of these guys were ever playing the game or writing or whatever. I will be around when they're gone.
It's their own fault. It's their
Yeah.
own fault. They have no one else to blame. All right. Well, Blaine, thank you for gifting the gab with me today. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. I thought it was really interesting. I think your perspective is really neat. your dedication to your audience, the way you seem to treat people, I really respect that. I have a great appreciation for creators who don't just, you know, who aren't just trying to be successful, but actually treat the people around them with kindness and respect and offer to help. That is like the number one thing I think the culture needs is more people like that, because I think that does have a knock-on effect to the whole fandom, to how people treat one another. And we need more of that. So thank you so much for all the good you do, Blaine. I think we're going to cut it here, guys. The Culturescape is put together with the help of our good friend at Bain Books, which is a Simon & Schuster imprint. Also, thank you to Young Voices and, of course, my editor, Chris Hollywicki. He makes me look more competent and put together than I actually am. I think you'd hear to Blaine. Blaine, what is some social media places we can find your work? They want to go look up one of your books or check out your Twitter. Where can they find
you? Honestly, go to Amazon.com. You can look at my books. Facebook, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. Those are the two primary platforms you can connect with me. And, you know, if you reach out to me and you're halfway civil, you know, I'll respond to your questions.
Nice. Well, that you heard the man. Go check his stuff out. And again, till next time, my friends, keep geeking out.